Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, viewers and listeners. And Judy, tell folks the title of today's episode.
Disinheritance, Betrayal, and Forgiveness, an interview with MB Cachetta.
We just finished that interview, and what a delightful person and delightful interview, and a great writer. She wrote a memoir that we both highly recommend.
Right. Just breeze through that, and, you know, just from her writing, we could tell she was going to be a wonderful person, and she certainly is.
She certainly is.
What a story.
Yes, indeed. So do hang around. We're just going to briefly introduce a couple things before we go to our interview. So let's just, you know, put on our usual plugs for our books and and et cetera.
Right.
Judy, pull up a book.
Okay.
Here comes one.
The latest book of yours, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
Available where anywhere you get your books, in whatever format you like, and then
and
a previous one.
The book that started it all, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
So do check those out, as I say, anywhere you want to get books. And I do mention in the interview, and you know, what got my attention about MB Cachetta, the person we were interviewing, was that she had written a modern love piece in the New York Times about being disinherited, which is a form of betrayal.
Right.
I happen to be working on a book called, the working title is Betrayal, Faith, and Forgiveness. And so I am collecting stories at this point. And so viewers, listeners, if you have a story of some kind of betrayal, and I'm casting a pretty wide net about that. It you know, it could be somebody cheating on you in a relationship, but it could also, there's all sorts of other kinds of betrayal, such as Mary Beth, MB, talks about being disinherited. Just drop me a line if you feel like talking about it. I could arrange to, we could Zoom together or something, or you could just write to me about it. I'm just collecting stories, and much appreciated if you would do that. Also, let me put in a plug for my newsletter. If you go to our website, which you'll see floating above our heads if you're watching this, ctn7.com, that's the number 7, you will see there's a little box you can check on to sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter. If you do that, we will give you, free of charge, a PDF of one of my booklets, which is called... Judy's pulling it out so she can show you those who are watching it.
7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life.
Indeed, and the PDF has all the pictures in it and everything. It's not pornography, folks. No. But it is, I think it's sort of a nice distillation of a lot of my ideas when it comes to this. Mm-hmm. Let's put in a word for our sponsor.
Okay, our sponsor is The Blue Tent. Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
Yeah, now that's not pornography either, but it is erotica.
It is erotica.
There is a
yes,
there is a distinction.
Yes, it's very sexy and very lovely.
And very explicit.
Very explicit.
And beautifully written and lovely for your sex life. And we know Laria very well, and actually in our last podcast.
Oh, well, we came out last week.
We came out. Laria is actually Judy.
Yes, that is my pseudonym.
Yes, and
my erotic pseudonym.
Yes, indeed. And I will tell you, folks, if I may speak personally, there's an audio version where Judy did the narration, and she does a dynamite narration.
Thank you.
So, indeed.
All right. Well, why don't we get on with our interview with Mary Beth?
And we'll see you on the other side.
Our guest today is MB Cachetta. MB is an award-winning author whose books include the novel Miracle Girls, a collection of short fiction entitled Pretend I'm Your Friend, and a memoir called A Cheerleader's Guide to Spiritual Enlightenment. She also works as a medical writer and content strategist. She lives in Massachusetts with the playwright Meryl Cohn and their standard poodle, Baby Cass. To quote a review by Augustine Burroughs of MB's memoir, I knew Mary Beth Cachetta was a brilliant writer from her modern love essay about being disinherited. What I didn't know until I read her stunning nonfiction collection is that she is also a trailblazing activist, ex-cheerleader, poodle-loving almost nun. And those aren't even spoilers. I love that. Mary Beth, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. I have to say I pulled together that intro, and I don't think we've ever done an intro of someone where I quote someone else's review, but I so love that review. And actually we were just telling you this before we started recording, and Judy and I both loved your book,
Thank you so
the
much. Put it
memoir.
down. I just could not put it
Yeah,
down.
that's so nice. Yes, Augustine Burroughs is masterful at blurbs and other things. He's a great writer as well.
Yeah, I'll have to see if he can. I don't know who he is, but I can see if he can do a blurb,
He
that.
wrote Running with Scissors. And
Oh, yeah. Of course.
there you know the name of that. Yeah, he's
Yes.
written a lot of wonderful books.
Yeah. So we always like to start off by asking our guests, how did you get into the work you do? Tell us something about your own journey.
I always wanted to be a writer, even when I was a little kid. I knew at some point I went to college, and they had an undergraduate sort of fiction workshop. I was very lucky, and so I it's like I got an MFA during my BFA. Then when I got to New York City, I thought I'll be a writer, but I realized really quickly that that wasn't going to be my fate. First of all, I had writer's block. Second of all my friends in New York City were dying of AIDS. So I became a medical writer, like just sort of by happenstance became a medical writer. I had a sort of capacity to do that, and a very, big interest because of what was happening in my community. So I have always been a medical writer. I worked freelance, and then I, at the same time, have been working on my fiction and nonfiction. And it just sort of worked out that way for me.
Yeah. This is a total aside, and I almost want to apologize to our viewers. This is like a real in question. You were involved in ACT UP.
I was.
I just wonder if you know our rabbi.
Oh, tell me who.
David Edelson. Does that name ring a bell? Because he
You
was
know,
very
I knew everybody by their first name pretty much. We knew each other by our first
yeah,
name. So
David.
I'm sure it's this thing
Yeah.
where in the world, if you're walking around and you see a face and you're like, oh, ACT UP, and they're like, yeah. So I probably do know him.
That's yes. I mean, it's a little like, oh, you're from New York. Do you know,
Yeah,
So
exactly.
anyway, sorry, listeners. Anyway, getting back to the main point here, as our listeners know, I've been working on a book about betrayal, which is actually why when I read your really thought-provoking article, and the one we saw was the one that just came out fairly recently. We're recording this for people who are watching this in December 2023, late December 2023, and when it came out a few weeks ago, I guess, right? And I hadn't realized until fairly recently that it was a follow-up to an earlier one you had done, what, back in 2011, 2012, something like that.
I had I was disinherited. My dad died in 2009, and there was a period of chaos where everybody hid the will and said they couldn't find it. They didn't want me to know what had happened, that I had been disinherited. But eventually I got a copy of the will from my dad's lawyer, a guy who lived down the street and was, our family friend, and realized I had been disinherited. And in 2011, I wrote the first article in Modern Love about being disinherited. And at the time, I was very in the, wait, what just happened? Like, it was a really big surprise.
Yeah, because you were blindsided by it, right? It's not like,
Totally.
oh, you were expecting it because he had told you, or there was nothing there.
No, no. And so, it caused a huge rift in my family, and you can imagine, as it does, it really does create a huge problem for
For
the
our listeners
siblings.
that don't know the story, would do you want to tell us some of the story?
Sure. Of which part of it? There's
Well,
so
if
much of
I,
it.
well, why you think you were disinherited, why you may have been disinherited, and why it was such a surprise.
Okay.
So I guess your backstory is.
Okay, so my father was a fighter of a man. He was a great guy, but he really was tough on his kids. I have three older brothers, and we all had periods of time where we had a difficult time with him. And And as my brothers say, well, you were the last one, you're the youngest, so you didn't get it worked out in time before he passed away. Their perspective was it could have been any one of us, and it just happened to be you. Everybody said, oh, well, you're a lesbian, you're gay, of course you were disinherited. But I don't think that that was really it. I mean, I do think if I had been married and stayed in town and had children, I probably wouldn't be. In fact, during my research, what I found out that most disinherited people have in common is that they move away from the family home from their parents. That's the one thing. The research is really terrible, and there needs to be more research and new research. But to me, that makes sense. If you're not the one there, that there's a lot that can get that can happen in that way, in terms of being disinherited. So, I had also had a hard time with him, and we had written each other notes, letters in the 90s when I was in my 20s and kind of dumb, thought I knew stuff. He said in the letters that he really only wanted the first child, my oldest brother, not the rest of us. So that was really hurtful to me, and I was really outraged. And I wrote him a letter that I said in it. I said, I see that you don't really love me, and so we can pretend that we're still family, but I'm going to erase you from my heart. And then 20 years later, even though we had made up, he hadn't gotten back to changing the will. And so when he died, there it was.
And you
And
didn't find out about the letters part, right, until a lot later?
So I mean, I knew I had we had had a hard time, and we were estranged for a little bit. And then when I got with my spouse, Meryl, I understood what love meant and what family meant, and it brought me back to my dad and to try to, make up. And we did make up, and we had a closer relationship. So yeah, I was surprised. I didn't really know what the words were. I leave nothing to my daughter Mary Beth for reasons known to her. So there was a whole thing like, what are the reasons? What are the reasons? And then I found that my father had a packet of these letters that we had sent each other that he kept in his safe. And it was quite clear then to me, and my mother affirmed that that was the reason that I had written that. And it's very interesting because writing is what I do. It's sort of my one talent or skill or God-given gift, however you want to say it. And I had used it to try to hurt my dad, and so that's something that I live with.
So, did your mother know this before? Did she knew that he had disinherited you?
Yeah, he was tough though. She said he tried to get her to change her will to match his, and she wouldn't do it. But she also, it was tough. She had to figure out whether she should tell me or not. And in the end, she chose not to, which for me was unfortunate because I think had I known, I would have approached my dad about it and tried to have a conversation and say, like, hey, I wrote that. I was a kid. I was stupid. I didn't understand about l love and relationships and family, and I do now, and I'm really sorry I wrote that, and I wish I had had the opportunity to say that to him.
So that's like another betrayal.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's like, my family is difficult.
It's interesting that phenomenon that, first of all, what I hadn't thought of that until you just said it, but I guess it's kind of obvious when I think about it. When you put something in writing, it sits there unchangeable until something,
Forever,
it is so different
forever.
from just
Be careful what you write, friends.
And then, well, if you, yeah, I was gonna, you just kind of said that, that if you knew he had disinherited you, you would have wanted to have the conversation. But if you knew he disinherited you, would you have had a relationship with him? Would have that have changed things? I know there's no way to know that, but
I don't.
thinking.
I think I would have. I think I would have understood that. No, I would have tried to have a relationship with him. I try to have a relationship with everyone in my family. I feel like it's important. I think it's really hard to do, and I don't think that ev it's for everybody. But I think it's really important to try to do that, to try to forgive myself, and forgive them, and know we're doing the best. Like, I think my dad was doing the best he could, and I think he would have really wanted to have changed it. I'm sure he would have regretted that this is sort of what happened to our family, which was a big kind of falling apart. But the happy part, which is what the essay in the New York Times Modern Love, the second one, which was the update, that was about my brothers did this remarkable thing. And it's something that siblings a lot of times don't do. Although I have to say, I've been getting a lot of emails from people who say, my brothers and sisters, my siblings did that. But what they did was they, there was one asset that was going to produce some sort of money. And that was a hunting farm that he left to my oldest brother. And my youngest brothers were allowed to use it. And then when he sold it, they were supposed to split it three ways, taking me out. But what they did was they split it four ways, and they each gave money to make sure that it was equally distributed among the four of us. And
that's nice.
Really touching to me. Yeah.
Friend going through something similar. Her brothers are not being as kind as yours.
a lot. I mean, it's interesting because, I don't know what would have happened if there had been money and it was right away, as opposed to it being this piece of land and getting sold 8 years later. But it is a remarkable thing that they did. And it doesn't happen a lot. And this is a really interesting time because, there's like $46 trillion that's passing from boomers and their parents to the younger generations.
Yeah.
And, people sort of say, oh, inheritance, it's a white person's problem. It's a rich person's problem. But 55% of Americans, and that is accounting for race and class, 55%, fully half, are going to get inheritances in the next several years. And we don't know the rate of disinheritance because nobody really pays attention to it. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see if that comes up a lot more.
Yeah.
We interviewed a guy named Carl Pillemer early on. This is episode number, I think it's 143 or something. We've been doing this for a while. But one of the earlier episodes was that interview with Carl Pillemer, who's a sociologist at Cornell, who wrote a book called Fault Lines about family cutoffs. And so it's sort of all sort of family estrangements.
Not necessarily disinheritance.
Yeah.
Estrangements.
But estrangements. And what he found, and this is excluding divorces, which of course has been studied up and down, but nobody was really studying these other kinds of estrangements that can happen, like between parents and kids, between siblings, between close cousins or close friends or whatever. So it's a pretty broad net.
Mm.
But what he found was at any given time, about a quarter of Americans currently are going through some kind of cutoff like that in their family.
That's
it's
really
incredibly common, and that's current. That's not like at any time.
Yeah.
And he found a subset of people who had made a point of at least trying to reconcile, often after decades, and every single person who tried were glad they tried, even though they
whether
didn't.
Right, whatever the outcome is. Yeah. I think I think as you get older, you kind of realize what's important. And that's your relationship with other people, and that's love, hopefully, and that's, growing up and seeing your mistakes and trying to be accountable for them. I mean, I can imagine that sounds like a great book. I'm gonna read that book.
Yeah, it was just this fascinating research, Fault Lines. Yeah, so I was also really taken by that scene in your memoir where you were addressing the 12-step convention.
Yeah.
And it was just very moving and sort of broadening the question some in terms of how you're able to, how could you cope with what you had to, how could you cope with that betrayal? And how do you find your way to forgiveness? I'm just curious about any of that.
Yeah, I did a lot of therapy. I did a lot of yoga. I did a lot of, trauma work, EMDR, and
one of my faves. I'm trained in that. I haven't been doing it since I've been doing
public. Oh, it's, I mean, it's been amazing for me. And I went to Al-Anon, for people in families where alcohol is an issue growing up, and or wherever, but for me growing up. So what happened to me was I really got a lot of sort of spiritual growth and this program, this Al-Anon program of honesty, and they asked me to speak at a roundup, which is it was a big tent in Provincetown. There were, you know, 1,500 people there, and I had never spoken even in a little meeting, so it was kind of crazy. I was like, whoa. So I got up and gave the speech, and I talked about, you know, my experience, strength, and hope. And at the end, it just sort of happened that people kind of leapt to their feet after, which was really nice and doesn't always happen. And it was just a sort of a weird, it was a great moment. We were really all connected, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just said into the microphone, what I realize is that you, this community of people trying to recover, this, you know, amazing group of people who just stood to their feet after I poured my heart out, you know, you are my inheritance, because I wouldn't have gone to Al-Anon if it hadn't been for that. And that feels really true. I think the disinheritance, you know, as anything big in your life, leads you into some really great places and can lead you into some really dark and hard places. I think after the disinheritance, I shut down quite a bit, and kind of went inside, and I wasn't as connected to people. I think I felt hurt, and I felt like life was very uncertain, and anything could happen, and I was blindsided, and I had already done so much to recover from my childhood, and sort of like, here it is all again in the disinheritance. Everything happens again. So I had to really work on that.
It's interesting as you describe it. And of course, 12-step programs being spiritually based. And I think that's an important part of it. When I talk about the notion of forgiveness, and of course, there's a zillion ways of even understanding the word, you know,
yeah.
I focus on the notion of forgiveness having basically essentially nothing to do with the person you're forgiving. It's about you.
Yeah. It's an inside job, as they say.
It's an inside job. And it's also, the way I like to describe it is it involves three steps. Again, this is just one of many ways of saying it. The first one being forgiving yourself, because even when it wasn't like, you know, and you were already there, you were saying, well, I wrote that letter, you know, you felt bad about that. But even if you hadn't, you know, I mean, I've had people who were sexually abused as children still blaming themselves, because that's a normal thing for people to do. It feels like it gives you some kind of control. So you have to be able to forgive yourself for at least not protecting yourself, you know, because doesn't always work that way. And then that when you get, and you already said it, when you get to that place of saying, well, I did the best I could, then you just extend that to the other person. Well, damn, they did the best they could too.
Yeah.
And then the third part, I call it forgiving God, whatever you think of God, because it's like we have this world that gives us this tantalizing sense that we have some control, and it's largely an illusion. And we have to forgive God for that. You know, it's like, all right, if I'm going to accept that this world, this whole existence business is fundamentally good, which is what I mean by faith.
Yeah.
I have to be able to do that. And then I can actually face whatever I need to face, I think, without getting into panic. Does that?
I think that exactly sums it up. And that's certainly, you know, it's a cheerleader's guide to spiritual enlightenment. And I think primarily, in the book, the memoir, I am, searching for God and meaning, and what is this about, and, you know, how do you live your life in a way that's meaningful to you, and for me now, gentle and open and kind and all of those things. That I think that's a great summary.
So you went to a I don't know, nunnery, a convent. Let's call it a retreat.
My friend, also a writer, a nurse, and an activist, Risa Denenberg, she was going to these retreats from New York City. I was living in New York before I moved to Provincetown with Merrill. But and she'd been going to these retreats. She's like, you can't believe it. Like, you can't believe how inexpensive it is. You can't believe how peaceful it is. And you got to go. So after Merrill and I got together, she got very, very ill. And almost died, and we weren't together that long, but we were really with each other and in it together. And then our own little personal crisis felt like it became this huge world crisis, because then 9/11 happened, and we were living fairly close to, we were downtown, and then we sort of got to escape to Provincetown. She has had a place in Provincetown that she got from after she wrote her first book. And so when I got there, when we got there, we were just like so traumatized by so many things. So I decided to go on this retreat, and Rita's like, "You gotta go. It's Genesis. It's a multi-spiritual. It doesn't, you know." But when I got there, it happened that there was a group of retreating silent nuns, and so, and then it was like clear that the women who ran it were also nuns, and so I had this sort of experience where I guess I just became open to sort of seeing the patterns and feeling like of just, you know, just in a short 4 days, like what happened over the course of the 4 days. I was writing about it as it was happening, and I could see that there were some miraculous things happening. And I really it really sort of helped me change my view on life, I guess. It was pretty profound for me to be there. And self-acceptance, I think, as you were saying, sort of step one there. So yeah, it was quite an interesting time for me.
I yet again recommend to our listeners reading your memoir, because you're that what was it, 5 days or something like that?
We have 4 days.
4 days, yeah. And that process, you know, you just described well, you know, you had all these spiritual insights and awakenings, but it wasn't easy. It's like,
No.
and you describe it very like you're a good writer. Who knew?
Oh,
You know,
thank you.
a lot of people know, I guess. And it's really moving to read, you know, how you went through that.
Thank you. Yeah.
And is the anger still there, or have you been able to let that go?
I think I've let it go. I think I'm, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, certainly wouldn't call myself in a perfect process or perfect in the process. So of course I still have, you know, times to where I really have to deal with it, but I think it's not the same as walking around and, you know, kind of stomping around, you know. I feel like I have processed a lot of it, thank goodness.
So now you were raised Catholic, and did well. I'm trying to think, like, how does guilt come into play? How does the forgiveness part come into play? Did you draw on your Catholic upbringing, or did you push that out?
I mean, I have had every kind of relationship with my Catholic upbringing. I think for a while, when I first went to New York City and everyone was dying, and I pushed it out. I was like, okay. And also, like, here I am, you know, member of the LGBTQ community, and the Catholic Church is saying, you know, hey, what you do is sin, and we don't want you, you know. And it was like very confusing. It's interesting to be talking about this on the very week that the Pope has announced that priests should and can bless unions between, you know, same gender couples. So that feels to me like some progress there. But I also, whatever I do, I have a very Catholic soul, I guess. It was, you know, it's that's who I am. I mean, I wrote one novel, and it took me so long because I kept fighting it and fighting it. I didn't want to, like, look in my heart and find that there were nuns there. Like, I just like, what? So, you know, it was very, very strange, but it became a you know, became this novel about a little girl who has visions. And is she crazy from the trauma that she's had, or is she having it, or is, like, she using religion to help her, or is she really having these spiritual experiences? So yeah, I think I've been all the way through the map and back on my Catholic upbringing and my Catholic spirit, and I think I'm accepting of it. It's just who I am, and there are things about Catholicism that really speak to me: the mystery, the forgiveness. I find it very moving. I think the last words in the memoir are love and mercy, and that is, to me, that's the incredible thing about Catholicism. separated from the politics and the people and the flaws and the sins of all of us, you know, that make everything super complicated and unfortunately hurt people. But there is an essence of it that really speaks to me.
That's so
That's the best I've ever had to explain that. So thank you for asking me that question.
Sure.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as you were describing that, I'm thinking it's very similar to what you were saying about the importance of family, that, you know, for so many people who were hurt in their childhoods, well, that's everybody to some extent, but some to a much greater extent than others, clearly. And to people who are really having to wrestle with serious harm that happened to them, you know, trauma from their childhoods, often it involves family, often it involves, you know, a church or, you know, other kinds of, you know, religious experiences. Sure. And I've so often known folks who have rejected it because of all the pain, and yet it's still a part of themselves. And it, especially Catholics, I've heard, well, actually, a lot of Jews too. Now that
Jews too as well. Sure.
It happens to us too. So in different, I think maybe different ways, but
yeah, my spouse Meryl is Jewish. And so we celebrate or we are engaged in both religions culturally and spiritually. So I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's everybody.
But that phenomenon that you can, I think it's a maturity thing as much as anything else, and maybe a sort of processing trauma thing, you know, when you can confront it without, without your nervous system descending into panic, then it's possible to say exactly what you said about your essential Catholicism, just like is saying what you said about your essential membership in your family, you know.
Yeah.
Good and bad, but it's really important to you. It's part of who you are. And, you know, so you wrote this novel and you realized you couldn't reject who you are.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Tried for a while, but you couldn't do it. They
I did.
A writer's block, right? More or less. Yeah.
Right. Right. That's a nice way to say it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can totally relate. I mean, you know, I'm Jewish, raised Jewish, but, you know, did not have great experiences growing up, but yet there was something that, you know, that I was able to draw on, that I did see the beauty past the other stuff, and that you don't reject something, you know, out of hand just because somebody pissed you off, something pissed you off, you don't like this, you know, the same thing that we were talking about with the family, you know, your siblings can piss you off, but they're still ultimately at the end of the day, your siblings.
Yeah.
So yeah, you gotta get beyond some of that crap.
Yeah.
Best way to put it.
And I mean, I found that for me, I had to go through it to get rid of it. I had to really grapple with it.
Yeah.
You know,
which I think is the only way you can really, you know, you can dissociate from it and then it comes back to bite you.
It does.
Or you can actually, and you mentioned EMDR, which I said, you know, I used to do that. And I mean, nothing is a panacea, but it's a very effective, often a very effective therapy for folks, precisely because it lets you do that without descending into panic.
Right.
You go there, and any of the effective trauma therapies will do that. They'll invite you to go there. You know, it's a form of exposure to the memories, but you feel safe enough that you can experience the memory as safe, even though the experiences weren't.
Right. It was a very effective tool for me, for sure.
Is your mom still alive?
She is. She's 91 years old.
Wow.
She flew. So crazy. There was a little family party in Boston with my older brother, and his kids live in Boston, and one of his kids live in Boston. And it's her grandkids. They really wanted her to go and celebrate my brother's birthday and be in Boston. So she did go, but she ended up in the hospital because she got pneumonia.
Oh my.
And so I live in Massachusetts, and they came from Rochester, New York. That's where I grew up, and that's where she lives.
I grew up in Buffalo, by the way.
Oh, you did? Oh my gosh. Wow, Western Mass. Yeah. Western New York. Yeah. But anyway, she, so, you know, Massachusetts is sort of my jurisdiction. She's in my town. So Meryl and I were there, you know, we went back and forth to Boston. We stayed over. She was there for 3 weeks, and then she got into rehab, and then she left feeling better than she had been for a while. So she's doing okay. She's back home. She lives by herself. She's driving. And we got to have this really interesting, I mean, you know, like sitting around in a hospital with somebody. She was at Tufts Medical and she got amazing care, by the way. But, you know, we had a lot of time to talk and it was nice. It was sort of this peaceful, nice connection that we had. So I really
relationship
I got that.
Like with her these days. So
yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, we talk on the phone. I see her when I can. Rochester's kind of far away. it's a big drive. And unfortunately, I still have some leftover lingering symptoms of long COVID. So I'm, you know, like I can't always drive to see her. So this was a nice visit for us.
Yeah, you wrote about your long COVID in the memoir. Yeah. So you say some leftover symptoms. You're doing better now? And
I am definitely doing much better. You know, sometimes it's, you know, by the day, like today I'm having a very good day. And what's great about it is I was reading a book last night and sometimes I can't really form a thought after I've been reading a book. So I am doing much better. I'm doing much, much better. Hope that it lasts and goes into the future.
This past Sunday's Times about long-term COVID.
Oh my gosh. That woman wrote an incredible, that she was like a data visualization person. That article was incredible, and the data and the way they did it. I just thought that was brilliant. Yeah.
It was brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to be a statistician before I was a psychologist.
Aha.
I remember when a guy, what's his name? Tufte, I think, T-U-F-T-E, came out with a book back in the late 70s, maybe 80s, where he talked about visualization of data. He actually went back to Florence Nightingale. Talk about, gee, I can get off on nerdy aside.
You're nerding out on us.
Florence Nightingale came up with this amazing visual representation. It was part of why she was so effective in promoting ideas about public health, because she was so good at figuring out ways of showing people.
Yeah, what was really going on.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. What else should we be asking you about?
Let's see. I don't know. Let's see, anything else that I would want to talk about? Disinheritance, my family, my brothers. I would love it if one of my brothers, there's three older and the middle one, he, it's interesting about him. He's very mad at me and doesn't speak to me because of, you know, things like this wonderful podcast and the articles in the paper.
Yeah.
You know, he thinks I'm sort of, you know, telling family stories and besmirching the name and only writing about myself. So I think that's kind of interesting because I have gotten so many emails from so many people who have said, oh, I'm not alone. And, you know, what do you suggest X, Y, Z? You know, so I have correspondence with all these people who've been disinherited. And so I feel like the articles have been helpful to people and really not just about myself, but I would like it if he could take a little tiny turn on that so that we could have a conversation about it someday.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm kind of taking a wild guess. Your brother won't be, he's not one of our viewers and listeners.
I don't think so. He listens to very conservative reactionaries.
You never
not
know.
Listening to this.
Yeah. But having said that, what I would hope he would be able to hear in how you talk about all this is the love, do you know, and the healing and the love, and even the sense of accountability to yourself, do you know what I mean, or for yourself, that yeah. sense that, well, yeah, this wasn't all one way, and isn't life interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking now back to Carl Pilmer's book, that sense that what lets people reconcile often is when they drop the need for the apology or the, you know, well, you have to understand why what you did was so hurtful or any of that stuff. They'll drop that and say, you know, it's been decades. We're different people now. How are you doing? And often what would happen is they would reconnect in a fairly superficial way. And then someone would say, you know, I've been meaning to say, I really feel bad about how I talk to you all
right time. Right then or, the apology
and so did I, and you know, and then they can actually have a deeper reconciliation. And sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. But that notion that the love is there, and if people were able to see that, it would be easier to, you know, sort of.
Yeah, I've written him the last time I tried to sort of approach him. And I think maybe he would have gotten over the 2011 New York Times article, but then my memoir came out and then the new New York Times. So I don't think he's going to get over it very soon, but I have written him and I've said, you know, as much as you are feeling contempt for me, I'm feeling love for you. And I really would like to, you know, reconcile and talk, but he doesn't write back. So
he doesn't
come off live with that.
No.
He doesn't come off that bad in the memoir. I mean, I was saying, oh my God, she has a horrible older brother. I'm thinking,
yeah, no, I was super careful. That was one thing I think I learned from the first New York Times article. Things got edited in a way that my family was like, we didn't have that many guns or, yeah. You know, or we didn't speak politics when you were young, you know, when we were young, like little things. And I said to them, but did you think the overall thing was true about, you know, my relationship with Dad? And they were like, yeah, but we didn't have all those guns, you know. but what I learned is, you know, to be very careful because I am telling my story, but my story also belongs to my brother's stories and we have the same last name. And so I tread very lightly around my brothers as much as I could.
Yeah.
And yet they ultimately did the right thing.
They did. They did. They're, yeah. You know, good boys in that way.
It's being a mensch, right?
They're mensches for sure.
They're mensches. Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
This was delightful. I'm so happy to meet you both and to just get a chance to talk on a Friday morning to you and your listeners.
Well, thank you so
much. Oh, and tell folks how they can find your, you know, your website and your information.
My website is mbcachetta.com, but that would be a whole spelling thing. So you can either just look up A Cheerleader's Guide to Spiritual Enlightenment. It's available on all the places where you get your books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You could go to the publishers, Engine Books is the name of the publisher, and you can order it there. And it makes my day when people talk about my book and maybe want to read it. So I would appreciate that. That's great.
Well, we highly recommend it too. So
absolutely.
Thank you.
Wonderful to meet you.
Great to meet you too.
Well, welcome back. We hope you enjoyed that interview with Mary Beth. We certainly did. And we've met a lot of wonderful people on our podcast, and she is certainly up there.
Absolutely. And if you would like to be one of those people, or if you'd like to recommend someone that we could interview, we're always interested. Just drop us a line. Go to ctn7.com. You'll see there's a way you can easily send us a message. And when you do that, we will be very grateful, of course. I've also been putting in a plug here at the end of our time. I've been saying, if anybody seeing this, just to see how many people are actually watching all the way through to the end here, if you are seeing this and you drop me a line and tell me that you saw me say this or heard me say this, I will give you a free PDF or even a download of an audiobook, just to thank you for telling me you saw this. So
there you go.
We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
So until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.